Welcome back, everyone, to Aspire to Lead, where we will be discussing the visions, inspirations, and experiences from top educational leaders. My name is Joshua Stamper, and you can connect with me on Twitter or on Instagram at Joshua_Stamper.
All right, welcome back to this bonus episode for both Thriving Educator and Aspire to Lead, as Charlie Peck and myself, Joshua Stamper, are here to follow up on our wonderful webinar. Charlie, before we dive into the Q&A section of our Behavior Prevention Strategies webinar, I just wanted to say thank you, and it's great to see you.
Yeah, you too. And I just realized this awesome graphic you have for our podcast. I love it. The Aspire and the Thriving Educator logo is very nice.
Yeah. So for those who are watching on YouTube, you can definitely see the graphic that I threw up there that we also had in our slides as we were working together on this really important conversation. And man, the webinar was so wonderful. It was great to see so many educators. Mm-hmm. I was going to say around the country, but it actually was around the world. Yes. Charlie, you had a better understanding of where our audience was coming from. So what were some of the countries that were in attendance for the webinar?
Yeah, it's awesome. It's so neat to see those come in. And of course, so many people are just across the U.S. was awesome. Also across Canada, different parts mm-hmm. of Canada, Greece, the Bahamas, the U.K. I had somebody from New Zealand show up. So oh, that wow. was really fun. Yeah, all over.
That's so cool. All right. So just for the format, for those who weren't in attendance, we went for an hour. And the idea was at the very end, we would have a Q&A section with the form that folks filled out. There was an opportunity for them to ask questions prior to the event. But of course, we went pretty long. And some folks even stayed after an hour. And we just had one-on-one conversations with folks, trying to help them out as best we could. But we thought, since we ran out of time, this would be a wonderful format for us to have a Q&A section. And so just so everyone has a full understanding, this is not rehearsed. Honestly, some of the questions I haven't even read yet. So I'm excited to see what folks pose. So this will be off the cuff. And then Charlie and I will do our best to work through these. So Charlie, if you're ready, I'll just start with the top question and we'll try to work our way down.
Yes, let's do it. Let's do it.
Okay. All right. So the first question is, how do you deal with students who consistently do nothing? They will tell you, I'm here because I have to be. I'm not going to do any actual work. Oh, I've heard that before. It does not matter if you write a referral. They just kind of have this laissez-faire attitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want to take it first? Or do you want me to?
Go for it, Joy.
Okay. Well, I've thought a lot about this question actually, because I've dealt with this so much as a teacher, and then working with teachers, I deal with it a lot. So here's my take on it. First of all, it's never anything you have to take on alone. So when somebody comes to us with this, it's not like we have to say, okay, go figure it out. We have to do some investigation and we get to look into what else is happening. I always say, ask questions like, what am I missing? If you ask nothing else, ask that question, what am I missing? So consider who you can actually ask that question to. That could be the student themselves. That could be the school social worker, the school counselor, the AP, a parent, caregiver, a teacher that they're actually performing for. Who are they working for and why are they doing it for them and not you? So a lot of times we have to put our ego aside here. That's so hard to do, isn't it, Josh? It's so hard to do.
Sure.
And then a couple of other things I'll say, and then I know you'll have something to add, Josh, but consider their history. I mean, have mm-hmm. they always been this way? Probably not. Where did that change? How long has this been happening? Why are they saying this now? And like, what happened to them to cause them to say this now? Yeah. So the other thing is they actually need a purpose and it needs to be relevant. And I think we already know that as educators, but I think we do forget that because we get wrapped up in the problem. So I'll stop there. There's a lot more I could say about this, but what's your take on it, Josh?
Yeah, I think considering their history was exactly where I was going to go. I mean, as an administrator, this happened all the time. Depending on the campus and the district, there were different types of ways to handle students that were, I was going to say obstinate, but they really were just not doing anything at all. And so I know for a teacher, being one myself, like it's hard when you have potentially 30 to 35 kids and you're trying to get everybody on task and working through the material to have the time to sit and really investigate what's going on. So as a minister, I did try to do my best to try and dig into the history. And there's always a story there. I mean, I can think of plenty of students that I mean, I'm thinking of one kid in particular that was kicked out of multiple schools in another state. He came to our state and his idea of school was like, I'm only going to be here for a short time before he kicked me out again. Like that was his idea of what the educational environment was. And so, you know, working with him and just trying to figure out like, you know, this is a different space. This is a different school. You know, I know that you had some poor experiences, but like, what do you want to learn? And so getting to the bottom of it and, you know, just having conversations about who he was, what he was interested in, and finding out like that he loved to read books. Great. That's a wonderful starting point. So me and him went to the library and, you know, I actually offered up an author that I really enjoyed and said, you know, have you ever read anything from this author? And he hadn't. And then pretty soon I found out that he read a whole series of books just from that. And it was kind of a turning point of understanding that we were not there to punish him. You know, he had this like preconceived idea of who he was as a student. And my task was to try and change that. And, you know, then sharing that with the teachers, like, this is his background. This is his history. This is what he's coming into with that. And it wasn't that he didn't want to learn. It was just that he had such negative experiences prior to being on our campus. And I think that that happens quite often where we uncover the root of there was something that was really negative that occurred prior, and they are bringing that with them into the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like we could do, honestly, an entire episode on this question. I really do. Because imagine how many kids are sitting there hijacked too.
Yeah.
I mean, I think when they're completely taken over by their emotion, that is not typical. And I think that there are some of those kids, but it's not typical for a kid to say, I'm going to do nothing, like to vocalize that, to actually follow through with that. I'm going to do nothing for you. Mm-hmm. Because what else is going on in their life is truly taking priority. And oftentimes that is true survival mode. Like, I've got to formulate a plan right now. I need to use this headspace to figure out what I'm going to do after school, when I'm going to walk through the door where I'm going to feel threatened. And it's legit in a lot of ways. So there's so many ways we could take this. Yeah,
for sure. And there's so many different experiences, negative experiences that our students have gone through. And I mean, like we always talk about behavior as language, like they are showing through their behavior and not following directions or being stagnant in their activity that there's something deeper going on. And it's just a matter of us finding the time to get to know them at a personal level and maybe uncovering something that we can help in regards to resources, or maybe just going at it a different way instead of just searching for a punishment.
Yeah. And a couple of other ideas I have, I think will show up in other questions.
Yes.
So let's go ahead and keep moving through the questions. And then
perfect.
I'll come back to it.
Okay. So the second question is, how can we respond to disappropriate data where economically disadvantaged students or students of color are being suspended at a higher rate?
Okay. So you dealt a lot with this systemically as a leader. So
yes.
Talk to me about that.
My blood boiling.
Right. I know you do. You go first.
Well, so on multiple campuses, I really dug into the data as far as getting in. And obviously, like first year as a leader in a building and as administrator, it's hard because you don't know a lot of things on the campus. And so for myself, it was truly doing an assessment the first year to understand what are the procedures, what are the practices, you know, what has worked, what hasn't worked. And the staggering thing was always this piece where it was an unbalance of students representation versus like people getting suspended. And so for instance, like we may only have 15% of Black students on our campus. However, 70% of the referrals and suspensions were of that race. And so for me, it was like, no, that there's something wrong here. There's a systematic indifference. And so I was very adamant about taking the data and sharing it with my staff and letting them know, like, obviously what we're doing isn't working, one, and two, there's an imbalance and there's no way on earth that 15% of our population should have this staggering rate of suspensions. So what, it's not like the other groups are not doing the same behaviors. However, the actions that we're taking with that are vastly different and that can't be the same. So we need to make sure that, you know, we're digging into that. And I will say that year two, year three, year four, all of the staff was very mindful of the data and our goal of you, because a lot of them didn't know it was happening. It was just, mm-hmm. It was just occurring. So now that it's brought to light, like this is a goal of ours as a campus, we need to have this number down and we need to find some other tactics other than just putting a student into a room or sending them home.
Yeah. And that's it right there, is having that conversation, making people just be aware that this is a problem and here's where it's coming from. And I know these are numbers, but there are kids and families behind these numbers that we do need to dive into because they're part of our population.
Yeah.
So having that conversation and normalizing the conversations, great. And then I always go from the strengths-based approach. Well, what is already working for them? What are we doing that's working well to support that particular marginalized group? Yep. And what have we already tried that didn't work? So where do we need to move towards? Like, what do we need to pivot around? What are those barriers, limitations? And here's one that I just really love to ask is, you know what? I don't know what to do. I'm not sure. What I've done isn't working. Who can I now go ask? Who has better information about that? Because we got to learn to step outside of ourselves when something's not working. We don't understand a population. We don't understand the numbers. So we've got to be able to do that as well.
This podcast is a proud member of the Teach Better Podcast Network. Better today, better tomorrow, and the podcast to get you there. You can find out more at teachbetter.com/podcast. Now let's get back to the episode.
All right, let's look for the next one. Okay, so this one's asked, how can I prevent escalation of minor behaviors becoming a major disruption?
Okay.
I know you're so all over this one.
Yeah, I know. I want to just throw this all in that chapter in the book. I'm almost done with that. Okay, so first of all, if kids don't have an expectation, they're not going to understand what it is that you want them to do. Mm-hmm. I think we all know this as educators typically, but if we're not reminding them of those or calling things out in a way that still supports them, right? And like showing them what we want from them, then they're just not going to always adhere to those. And then it's going to be kind of disarray. So we always just literally came up with the rules. We co-created the rules and then we posted them around. And so making them very simple and clear so that when you're in the midst of teaching, for example, it's going to look a little different for leadership. But when you're leading a classroom, you're able to say, hey, wait a minute, is that something that is posted up there that we're actually following? Did you just follow that piece up there? Is that the appropriate language or respectful language that we all talked about? So we need to actually spend time setting that up in the space before we all engage in the space. So that happens the whole first week, sometimes the whole first month. And by the way, if you think that I'm talking about just early grades and kindergarten, you're absolutely wrong. I taught high school. I did this with my senior AP level students every single time, because we have to all know what the expectation is. And then when somebody's going to, and I know you're thinking, oh, AP students don't do, they don't step out of the boundaries. Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And there's a whole piece with gifted students and high level thinkers. But okay, so that's just a very small piece of this. So here's another thing, is we've got to actually look at prevention. We don't want the escalation going there. So if we know that there's something minor that is showing up and we don't address it, and which sometimes can be a strategy, is to ignore it, but not that's actually not pretty typical to just ignore it. So what we need to do is think, we've got to know those students so well, or we have to know the group dynamics so well that we do notice a shift. And so when you notice that kid is getting shifty or their affect is changing in their seat, or these two people who, you know what, when they start whispering, something else bigger is going on or is going to happen, I need to be able to stop. So that's when I always pull in like rapid resets, or depending on the relationship I have at the time with those particular students or the group, I might call it out and say, hey, what's going on? You know, I might joke around it. I try to be playful. And then you have to assess what's going on as it's playing out. So it is a craft that you kind of learn over time, but it's really about setting up the space. You got to set up the space for prevention. And then when something is starting to happen, we don't want to get too far with it. And we also don't want to raise to the level of where it's going. It's that ladder of conflict. So if you've ever worked with me, you might have heard the ladder of conflict. And so when somebody's raising their voice, for example, or their emotionality is raising, you don't want to raise with them. You want to stay on the bottom rung of that ladder. If you can just visualize a ladder and every rung that you climb is some kind of emotional escalation, right? So you might be uncomfortable, which we're all uncomfortable sometimes. We don't know how to sit there very well. So we might go to irritability, and then that could go all the way to rage, right? And you know those students who skip those rungs and sometimes go right to rage. So we got to catch them when you notice discomfort. And most importantly, we've got to recognize our own discomfort and make sure we can stay at the bottom of that ladder. Okay, there's more to this, but go ahead, Josh. I know you have more to say.
No, I think the relationship agreements, we both speak on this in regards to making sure that the students have, you know, autonomy within the classroom and have agreed upon that. And that is something that should be addressed and brought up throughout the year. It's not a first of the year thing. It should be something that's visible and used constantly, and it's not set in stone either. If there's something that is brought up throughout the year, you can add and subtract to that agreement. There's nothing wrong with that. So I love that point. And then also, I always ask my staff, like, what do we have control over, right? So, I mean, obviously, a kid's going to get irritable or bored or, you know, have different emotions throughout the class period. But like, what are you able to control in that situation? And one of the things, and I'm just going to echo what you said, is like, we shouldn't be the cause of the escalation, right? We have a lot of power in our communication with our students, and we need to be mindful of not only our tone, our volume, but then also presence. Like, there are so many times that I can think of a large adult towering over a kid, and that triggers them to feel unsafe, and it quickly escalates to something much bigger than it need to be, or trying to block a kid walking in the hallway. And you know, like, there's so many things that I can think of where it sets them off, where it shouldn't have been a major issue, but it turned into that due to the adult and the way that they were communicating and having a physical presence over them. And so I just think that when we're working with our kids, we should always search for the easiest way possible to communicate and make it so that it is minor and stays minor. Because once it gets to this escalated state, I mean, there were such things that, like, took over the campus, took over my time, took over the teacher's time, took over the parents' time, like, when we could have really kept it at a very low level incident. And so I would just ask that, you know, what do you have power over and how can you keep it minor?
Yeah. And I'm going to add two things there because it piggybacks off what you just said there, Josh. It's super important. I want people to insert these two words into their vocabulary, is notice and need. Mm-hmm. Because what we need to do is start saying to the other person, whoever we're sharing space with, that we're noticing something's off. Or again, it often starts with us. It really does. And then they notice a shift in us, don't they?
Right. Yeah.
But I noticed that you did this, and try to be completely like, take your opinion out of it. I noticed that you just shifted there. And I'm just wondering, is there something that you need? Or, oh, if nobody could remember any of like the big things, just remember this. What do you need? Ask what they need. And we can ask ourselves, what do I need? And if we just leave it as like a needs-based approach, like, this, there's some unmet need going on here, and I want to help you get that, that's going to keep it from blowing up in the first place. So yeah, notice a need.
Notice a need. I love it. All right, let's move on to the next one. So I'm going to change this because it's not really quite a question. So I'm going to pose it that way. How do we break the cycle of behavior and encourage students to believe in themselves and that they are better than what they came from and what they are around?
Wow. That's a big one. And here's what consistently over time kids will do with you. If you constantly let them know, you send the message that they are important and they are valued. And when they're gone, it's not the same for you and the group when they're gone. Or listen, I know that was a struggle in the past when we first started trying this thing, but do you remember when you overcame that? It can be so small. Remind them of the things that they overcame to help encouraging them to believe that, wow, that was a really minor thing, but at the time it felt big. And I did that. I did that thing. And also, I think this is really big in that where they came from, because there's a lot that can be in that backstory for them. And what I'm going to say is I don't equate people's backstories to other kids, because one might feel really big and look really big to one person, and to the next, it may not be nearly as big. So everybody has a history. Everybody's coming from something. And as long as we treat each and every kid, regardless of their struggle, that they are a valued person in the space with you, and you consistently do that. And there are strategies around that, but that consistency will speak volumes later. I mean, there's a kid I had in ninth grade, and this kid was not vocal at all. He was quiet, and there were so many things going on in his background. And it turns out he and his mother were actually staying in a women's shelter at the time that he came into my classroom. And I ended up teaching that kid for 4 years. He kept coming and taking my elective classes. And I'm still in touch with this kid. He's doing really well, but he didn't really know where he fit. And there was a lot going on. He didn't really value himself. But we poured into him and we made him realize that he is super important and he's doing great things in society right now. So I know you probably have a million of those stories, Josh.
Oh, yeah. And I loved mentoring kids too and making them understand and providing like very specific feedback of their strengths, because we can't assume that they're going home to an environment that is showering them with love and with, you know, just allowing them to understand that they're great human beings. And so like, we have to feed that when we have the time with them. And so there were plenty of students that I did various check-ins. You know, it was just a quick, like before school, come to my office, let's check in. I do a number system, see where they're at, because I knew a lot of times they had chaotic things going on in their life and at home. And so I wanted to make sure that before they even entered a classroom, I had an opportunity to get the resources they need. Maybe they just need to chill out. Maybe they didn't eat food the night before or that morning, get them a bottle of water, get them some snacks, you know, get them ready for their day. And so I felt that was extremely beneficial, but then also gave me an opportunity to really dig into who they were and then just to tell them that they were going to have a great day. And if they needed anything, to come find me and, you know, things like that. So I think there's a lot of things that can be done to break the cycle, but I think it really is, you know, just taking a couple of minutes each day. And I know plenty of teachers that I worked with, they would get down on one knee and spend a couple of minutes every day with a kid that they knew was struggling and just to pour into them and to tell them that they were so glad to see them and they were so glad they were in their class and, you know, just kind of pump the tires a little bit, right? And let them know that they're appreciated, they're loved, they're accepted in that environment. And, you know, like you said, if they're gone one day, we missed you. You know, you're a valued piece of a valued member of this classroom. So doing as much as we possibly can to let them know with like very specific feedback of like why, you know, we think that they're a special human being.
Yeah, for sure. Because sometimes that takes something really tangible to do. So for example, choice. I know we talked a lot in our society about choice, and I think it does get some eye rolls over time. But when we're talking about these kids who may not go to an environment where they feel valued at all, they need to have some kind of choice because it empowers them. It can be so minor, right? Do you want to do this topic or this topic? That might be the biggest choice they got to make. And the first time they got to use their voice, right? It's really powerful. But if we can do that a lot for them, even in small doses, it can have huge results. And the other thing is, we have to be careful not to be condescending. These kids see right through it, don't they? And so we've got to notice what they respond to with praise, because you might actually, like we might, I've done it millions of times actually, shut kids out with praise because they know or they don't believe you or they think it's condescending. And if we are being condescending, which we can be, they pick up on it so easily. And I also will say, be careful with sarcasm. The kids who you're struggling with the most, do not use sarcasm, because they may not be able to interpret it properly. And they also might appear like they're laughing or think it's funny, and it's actually really not funny to them. They just don't understand it. And it might be one more kid that you're trying to connect with and you're just shutting them out again. So, and I do have a tool, but I'm not sure if I should use it here because it will apply to a lot. Should we go on to the next one and use a different tool or just throw it out there?
No, go for it, Troy.
Okay.
It connects to this question, so I think that's great.
Okay. And then you, of course, too, I know you have a lot to add too, so I don't want to hijack the conversation. Okay. So one very powerful tool I use with these kinds of kids, right? Especially the first one we talked about too, doesn't want to do anything. Mm-hmm. And this kid, or the kid who you know is going to raise and then conflict. There's a lot of big things that we think we have to do, but we actually keep this one really simple. And here's one of the things we do is path of possibilities. It's a visual that we show them when we have time, well before any conflict or well before any time that we get together. So at the very beginning of a session or the very beginning of a class, we will show them a path of possibilities. And all it is what don't you want and what do you want? And this next move that you're going to make, is it going to help you lean towards what you want or what you don't want? And if it sounds simple, it absolutely is. It has to be, because when we're in the midst of chaos or we can't reach kids, we have to simplify it even further. And so I have a visual for that. But also, if you just picture it, you can use it like that. Like, well, what do you want? And what don't you want? And what you're about to do right now, if you're about to leave class and you know you're not supposed to, is going to get you to where you want. So there's a lot of little things we can do around that too. But use simple language and simple visuals to help them decide which path of life they just want to go on.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on something that you said earlier too. And I think it just goes along with everything, is when you were talking about how, you know, they may not interpret sarcasm. And I would say that, you know, anyone that's gone through trauma, that really does affect a lot of variables within the brain. And so even just like maturity levels, right? They, one of the foster trainings that we went through would talk like, if you have a 12-year-old, cut that in half, they probably have the maturity of a 6-year-old. And, you know, for a student who's in middle school, you know, acting like an elementary student, or maybe not even interpreting different things, a lot of times we just look at them and we say, oh, you should have these skills and you should act your age. That's something that says is said a lot in schools. But at the same time, we have to understand that there might be a lot of things that are occurring in the brain due to their own experiences, negative experiences. And so we can't just, you know, take that as, okay, they're a 13-year-old, so they need to act like a 13-year-old. There might be some things that are missing within their maturity to grasp sarcasm or other things. And then when you were talking about like laughing too, a lot of times students will laugh because they're uncomfortable. It's not because they think it's funny or that they're enjoying the experience. It's due to the fact that they don't know how to really react in that situation. And if they're uncomfortable, that's a very common way to handle it, is through laughter.
Josh, how many students came to you and said that they thought their teacher was being mean to them? And you, like, you had that teacher who thought they had a great relationship with a kid.
Yep. All the time. Every day. Yeah. Yeah. Every day. Literally. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And we have such good intentions, but if we don't understand the brain, we don't understand trauma, we don't understand how marginalized, vulnerable kids misinterpret the world around them because they're forced to. I mean, they have no other choice. They have no other lens, I should say. They have a choice, but they don't know what their options are always. Yeah, it's up to us. We can actually guide that. And it doesn't always take long. I want us to all just believe that we can actually do this together. It doesn't always take all this big work.
Yeah, for sure. All right, we have a couple more questions here. Okay. So let me get to the next one. What are some new strategies for teachers struggling with students? And I guess it's a very short and quick question there. I was thinking it was longer.
Why don't you take this one first?
Well, I think the main thing is like keeping that relationship. You know, I want to go back to what you just asked, right? You asked like how many kids that I had asking if their teacher liked them or not. And I think the major reason is because I think a lot of teachers are so quick to kick students out of their class. And what is happening is that there's a break within the relationship. And what is being interpreted by the student is that this teacher doesn't want me. They don't want me in this class. They want me in this environment. Mm-hmm. And not to say that every behavior needs to stay in the classroom. Obviously, if it's a very high level negative behavior, then that takes additional people and resources and whatnot. So, but for a lot of like minor things, I had students coming to my office because the teacher would just send them away. And so what we have to understand is, like, in a typical campus, what happens is when a student is sent to the principal's office or administrator's office, that there's no conversation between the teacher and the student after the fact. There's no resolution. There's no fixing the relationship that is obviously broken. So what happens is that someone else fixes the behavior, supposedly, and then the student is supposed to magically go back into the classroom and they have, you know, supposed to, you know, kumbaya environment between the teacher and the student when nothing has actually been worked through and there's no verbal conversation occurring between the two parties. And so we have to realize that that break needs to be talked about. It needs to be discussed. And so, you know, I don't think it's a new strategy. I just think it's taking time to build the relationship. And it's just like your family, right? Like my kids, if one of my boys hits another boy, I'm not going to send them into the room for 8 hours and then never talk to them about the behavior, never teach about what my expectations are for the future if they were to do that or come into that same situation again and how they should handle it. So like, if I'm not doing that at home with my kids, why would I expect the school to be any different, right? So we need to build time into not only build healthy relationships, but then also let them know, like, you are a part of this environment and I do care about the relationship, and we need to teach the behavior that is expected. So I don't think it's a new behavior, like a new strategy, more so than just making sure that we are investing time in when a relationship is broken, that we are coming back to the table to mend that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people think, well, I have 30 kids to do that with. Yeah, that is what we do. It's true, but it can be done, can't it?
It can be done. I've seen it done.
Yeah, you have. I know it's true. And you've got such a great lens for that too. So it's just important. And if I bring it back to the classroom level about what are new strategies for teaching struggling students, well, traditional education, y'all, is just not working well. I think we know this. And it's time for change. It's time for change. But guess what? You're not changing the system tomorrow. You're not going into your job tomorrow and changing the system. You're just not going to do that. So what can we control? What can we do? Well, kids love it when they're a part of the learning. So ask them what they want to learn. Ask them how they want to learn it. Give them some options. Sometimes kids just want some downtime, but other kids might want to do partner work. And so one of the things I did is I got to a point where I didn't force partner or group work. I gave it an option. Now, I know some people are like, oh, well, you have to. It's part of it. Sure, there are some natural things that we did. But I also noticed that some kid that came into class struggling or was just quiet that day, and I was able to say, okay, this is the topic we're learning about. You could also do the podcast activity. And I already always had that set up where I had a list of podcasts and topics so that either when they were done with what we absolutely had to do, or they just wanted to do research on that topic on their own, and I had a list of like topics they could get. They could actually go and listen to a podcast and fill out this worksheet. That was really a quiet environment for them, but they're still learning. And depending on the level that I was teaching, I would have them assess if it was a credible resource and why, or what are some other ways that they can make sure it's credible. Like, you could tie different things in, and I already built that up. But the point is just notice what their mood is and allow some adjustment for that, even though there can be the same learning outcomes. Something like that goes a long way, especially when you're dealing with some kids that come in a lot with behaviors. And then just get them comparing some things. So one of the things I got to teach about in sociology were different systems of the world. But you can actually pull some pieces in that way. So if they say something, if you hear your kids making comments about, this is boring, this isn't great, have them do some research about education systems in the world and what makes those great. So why don't you turn that into a presentation and like just adapt what your topic is, and then have them bring it in and have everyone learn and adjust to those kinds of things. Make it real world. There are so many things that we can do. If we just think about it, like, here's a problem. How can we solve that problem? I keep hearing you all. I notice you all are complaining about this. What can we do as a class to make that a different way to learn in here together? And there's going to be more buy-in because they're going to be a part of it. And there's lots of those little things to do, but just listen to them and try to adapt.
Jelly, I'm going to pull in another question that's very, very similar to what we're answering in regards to end of the year behaviors. So obviously we're in the spring right now. And so I know that you have like the spin a wheel daily activity thing. So I would love for you to kind of share that and maybe anything else that you're thinking of that ties into just kids right now in the spring, maybe are having summer fever already, even though we're still maybe a month out from the end of the school year.
Yeah. I mean, and what I want to first say is we don't have to do a circus act to do this either. I mean, it's teachers are so overwhelmed, and it just keep it simple. Like,
yeah,
have the kids do as much of it as you can. So for example, the spinning the wheel, just have them come up with activities they want to do. It could be about the same topic that you're learning about, but what are different ways? Like, do I want to listen to a podcast? Do I want to do a presentation? Do I want to watch a video? And if they want, always choose video, of course, there's a wheel that they're going to spin.
Right?
Gonna get it. Yeah. Do you want to have a partner chat about this? Do you want to figure out like a problem-based way to do this? And do you want to do a jigsaw puzzle, or do you want to do a literature circle around this? Whatever. we all know strategies. We're teachers, right? We've learned tons of strategies. So put those in like little envelopes or just create a little wheel and have them spin it. You can make it really simple. You could go to an old game. You could get a Twister and get like, you know, that little spinner and just put different activities on there. And to change it up when you know they're bored and you're wanting to teach about a topic or you want them to go do independent work, well, okay, guys, let's spin the wheel. This is what we're going to do now. Or sometimes you get to choose lucky winners to come up and do that. It's just little things just to mix it up. But also like Pictionary, if you're doing review, have them all write down different topics you're learning about. Put them in like a little container and then put them into teams or have them do it individually in partners or little groups. Have them pick out one and somebody has to draw it and see if you can guess. So you're just always connecting, but in fun, super simple ways. Have the kids come up with a lot of it. And I'm going to end on this part. What we've forgotten to do is teach kids about how their brains work. And when we teach them how their brains learn and how movement might be really important to one kid, and listening might be really important to another kid, or visual or kinesthetic learning is important to different kinds of kids. Teach them about themselves as learners and help them be in charge of that learning experience too, and to vocalize that. So there are so many little ways that we can adjust education within our own classroom that moves away from the traditional space, which a lot of us are already doing. A lot of you educators are already doing that.
All right. I'm just pushing all kinds of weird buttons over here, Shelly. So disregard what I'm doing in the background. All right. Moving on.
Well, disregard me going on a tangent because there are just so many ways we can do it. Even just movement is helpful for all age groups.
But that's the thing is we get in these routines and then by the time we get to March, April, May, the students are like, I'm good. I'm done with this. Like, so I think what you're saying is completely on track as far as changing it up, and it doesn't have to be hard. You don't have to reinvent the wheel talking about wheels. We can do something just very, very simple, just to mix up for the kids and get them more engaged. All right. I think this is our last one, which is how would you respond to teachers who shoot down your ideas to give students various things like fidgets, wobble chairs, other movement activities for various reasons. I know there is kind of two sides of thinking with this. So Charlie, how would you respond to a teacher who's like, nope, this isn't good for my classroom?
Yeah. First of all, I would listen to them. I would say there's two ways I would take this, actually several, but the first way I would, and I remember who asked this in there, and my first response was, so like, they don't know, but I also would ask the teacher, I would respect what the teacher was asking for, because that teacher is the leader of their classroom and they know those students better than I do in that context. Okay. So let's just respect what the teacher is asking for, but then I would uncover that even further. So if I believe that these kids actually would benefit from this and they're just pushing back on that, I would try to figure out, well, why are they pushing back on this? I actually do think this particular group of kids would benefit. Like, I know these kids need some more movement. I notice it. I hear it. And why is this teacher not giving them space to do that? So I would try to figure that out, because I'll tell you, educators typically want their kids to do well, right? There are, it's a very small number of educators who are in sharing a space with our kids who don't want them to thrive. And so if they're pushing back, it's probably because they're overwhelmed with something, or they're sick of being told without understanding the why behind it, or they're sick of hearing the same things over and over they've tried that don't work for them. So it's a partnership. So yes, I sometimes say, so they don't want to do it, but okay, I'm going to actually get in there and show them why this is going to help their kids and then work with them on a plan for that. But also I do need to listen to what they have to say and their concerns, because you're going to lose trust with them too. And they'll never listen to you at that point.
100%. Yeah. I mean, you can suggest things all you want, but I mean, they have to find the value in it to implement it, to see if it works for them. And there's been plenty of teachers where the person right next door tried something and worked for them. They tried, it didn't. And so they never implemented moving forward. And that's fine. I mean, the main thing is, can we find an engaging environment for our students to master the content in the classroom? And so, you know, what it looks like for teacher A is potentially and probably going to look different for teacher B. So I don't think that's something that we need to die on the hill for. I mean, you can obviously make suggestions, but it's up to them to, you know, take that and put it in their classroom or not. So I think it's really about, you know, caring for the student the best way possible. And everyone's different. And especially if it's a different subject matter. I mean, there's things that, you know, an art teacher can get away with or an English teacher can do that, you know, a math teacher may not be able to do. So we have to take that into consideration that these are different people, but then they're also different subject matters and different content, different activities. So yeah, I wouldn't take too much into that, but I would for this teacher, you know, whoever asked it, like, keep doing what you're doing as far as experimentation. I always told our teachers, like, I don't care if it doesn't work, at least you're trying it, right? I want you to try. I want you to see if it's something that can be incorporated into your environment that's going to help our students. And if it is, great, let's keep it going, you know? So I was one for experimenting with things as much as possible, even if it took away a little bit from the educational experience, because, you know, there's other things that are important. We have to teach math and science, all this other stuff, but we also have to teach the future ready skills for our kids. And if a kid is, you know, dysregulated, then we also need to have an environment that's going to get them back on track. Because as we know, if they're in that state, they're not learning.
They're not. And there are so many universal things that we can do for kids. If we just treated every single student like they had ADHD, we would prevent a lot of behaviors, wouldn't we?
For sure.
And this particular person that asked that question, she's a school social worker. She's newer at it. And so she's trying to build confidence and having those conversations with teachers who are probably seasoned teachers, a lot of them. And I would always say this, if you can implement something, if you really do believe that what you can do is helpful, then offer to do it for the teacher. And that way you're at least showing the teacher and you're saving time so they don't have to plan anything new. Carve out 10 minutes, offer to lead it, offer to show the value of it. But also the teacher will be like, see how the kids are responding to you, right?
Yeah.
And they'll get a better feel. But if you're a teacher, I don't care if it's K through 12, I don't care which level, I don't care how long you've been in a teacher, whoever that school counselor is and whoever that school social worker is in your building, if you are blessed to have one or more, get a good, strong partnership with them, because they are extremely valuable to prevention and helping you throughout this whole process, no matter where you are. Get your ego aside and get to be best friends with them in the building. It's helpful.
For sure. And I would say 504 coordinator and ESL and all these other folks that can assist with, you know, because there's so many needs out there. So for sure, you can't do this work alone. It's a team effort. So make sure that you're tapping into your team. And yeah, I love what you're saying. The context too, Charlie, thank you so much for sharing that, because I didn't know that about the person asking that question. But yeah, I mean, if you can take something off their plate, I mean, of course, you're probably going to get a stronger yes if they know that they have support in that. Charlie, I did skip a question. So I guess this is our bonus question for this bonus episode. We had provided resources. So this person is thanking us for the resources that we provided, but they also want to know if there were any behavior tools or free webinars in the future for students in special education.
Yeah, I would say a lot of these strategies work very well for kids in special education. And that's why I don't know about you, but I would suspect that a lot of people who are in special ed leadership roles and special ed, even just special ed roles, they come to you because you still give valuable information that can work for that particular population too. And that's, our skills do that too, because they are simple, right? Yeah. Oh, look at you. You put thrivingeducator.org up. Thank you. That's my website. It's true though. I mean, these skills are skills that just invest in human capital that I'm using and I know that you're using. And our book is marrying together and helping with a different part of this to get the buy-in first and to get ready to even acquire the skills. But so for me to have a blanket answer to that about, yes, this particular skill, I just said it before, just pretend every single kid in your class is ADHD, because all the strategies that go in those 504s, they can work for kids across the board typically. Yeah,
for sure. And the things that are happening in special education as far as strategies are things that can definitely be used in other areas of the campus. They are universal strategies. And so we have to understand that. And the reason I threw up Charlie's website is because she's got wonderful things that you can download from her website and you get on her email list. I know you're providing webinars all the time, Charlie. I swear I see it on Twitter that you're, you know, doing constant webinars on a variety of different subjects. So in regards to behavior, and then of course our resource. So Charlie, I know we talked about this during the webinar, but I guess we probably should talk about it here on the podcast too. Do you want to talk about the book a little bit?
Yes, the book. Okay, before we talk about the book, we have, I meant to say this before, the relationship inventory. You've got to put that link up too, because we keep talking about build relationship. Well, the relationship inventory is a strategy, is a checklist that you already use, which is amazing. You guys have got to get this. Make sure you download it. Josh, how do they get that?
Well, I'll throw it up on my website. So joshdenver.com. I'll make sure that it's on the front page for everyone. But yeah, I've used it for years myself as an administrator, going into classrooms. I mean, it's one of those things, is they may seem easy, but it is data-driven, right? These are strategies that we know increase engagement and decrease student behaviors. And so I figured I would just compile this kind of checklist to go and be able to use, and it could be used for a teacher, it could be a counselor, it could be an administrator, it doesn't really matter, but it's either you're assessing your own environment or you're assessing your campus. And as we know, building healthy student relationships only is going to help the school culture. And so wanted to provide a free resource for everyone. So I'll make sure I put that up on my website.
Yes, please do. It's really important and valuable. Okay, so the book. So we're really excited about this book that's coming out. We're trying to pull together so we can have it out by the fall, early fall for everybody.
Yes.
Right. And so the work that Josh and I are already doing is making a valuable impact with schools and leaders and educators that we're working with, and parents, by the way. But sometimes we have a hard time understanding how to be in a position to receive that information or to actually implement it. And so Josh and I are getting together to come up with a plan that we're going to share with you soon in this book to help you with that. And it's very practical as well, because if it's not practical, we're not going to use it. And it's not just theories. We've got the stories to share that where it actually worked. And we're going to show you step by step how to use this. So is there something you'd like to add to that?
No, I'm just excited that we have two varying lenses. You know, we have different perspectives in the educational environment, but I want to just key in on what you said, which was like things that we've done that have been successful. So we have not only the research behind it, but then we also have stories of things that have worked on the campus level. So it's not just theory, right? It's actual steps that we have taken ourselves that we want to share with you, so that it is something simple that you can start to implement. And yeah, I think the way that we have it as far as three principles is very simplistic for folks, and gives everyone an idea to assess what's going on their campus, but then also be able to implement what we're sharing to hopefully, you know, change not only student behavior, but then also, like I said before, with the relationship checklist, is just changing the culture of your campus.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm excited about it. We do have a pre-sale list. So some people, because they want to know when it's coming out and how can they get it. And so we are putting people on a pre-sale list. So I just shared that list or the link that we can put in the show notes. And you can get on that list too if you all want to. But
If you're watching on YouTube, I'll make sure I have it in the description, but it's on the screen here, thrivingeducator.myflowdesk.com/presale. And then you can get on that list, and we'll make sure that you have that information for when the book drops.
Yeah, I'm excited. What is the number one thing that you're looking forward to there, Josh?
As far as the book?
Yeah.
I always just love hearing stories of things that resonate with folks. I know that happened with your book, and I've definitely experienced that on Aspire to Lead. But yeah, just seeing how it impacts folks, because a lot of times it's things that you don't even think about. And so I'm just curious on like how it's not only going to affect individuals, but campuses, but then also like, you know, just what resonates with folks as far as stories, and maybe there's a strategy, or maybe it's even just looking at their own background as far as being a student and how maybe they struggled and, you know, are able to make an impact as an educator now. So yeah, I think just like the feedback from folks, I mean, it's fun to get feedback from those who are attending the webinars, but it's another thing for when a book goes and gets launched. What about you, Sean?
Yeah, no, same idea. I mean, there was a gap when I'm going out to these schools and districts teaching the skills. There was like something that was missing that was right before that they were trying to understand before they grasped it. And I think this is the missing piece. I know it's the missing piece. That's why I'm excited for sure about it. Awesome. And I'm excited to do this with you. I really am.
Yeah. I keep sharing this, but it's been such a blessing, Charlie, to work with you. And I really feel like it's been seamless. Like, I don't know, the conversations I feel energized by, and writing with you has just been such a joy. So I'm super excited to get it all finished and you know, blast it out to everyone. And looking forward to the feedback too from folks. And please let us know if there's something that is resonating with you from this conversation, or if you attended the webinar. We're always looking for, you know, items that we can put in the book to make sure that it's a resource that you find useful, valuable, and is able to help you in your educational leadership journey.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you guys for being here. And Josh, thanks for hosting.
Of course. We had to flip the script because Charlie, you hosted last time. So yeah, super excited for everyone. Definitely check out Charlie at thrivemanagehere.org. You can reach out through the website if you have any questions or any feedback for Charlie, and joshchamber.com for myself if you want to do the same. So with that, thank you, everyone. And we look forward to having additional conversations about this topic.